From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Welcome to episode number 163 and the return of podcast favourite Richard Morris. If you haven't listened to them already, go back and check out his previous episodes to find out more about him and what he really thinks about calories. I'll put links in the show notes, which you can find at ketowomanpodcast.com/163 or via the link in the description wherever you are listening to this episode. Richard is a 55-year-old software developer and technical speaker who built financial systems to expose risk on Wall Street and has worked on systems from industrial robots to payroll. At 38, he was the public-facing chief executive of a major software component company when he discovered he had type 2 diabetes. At 40, he retired to devote his time into learning about type 2 diabetes and reversed his own with the ketogenic diet 7 years ago. With Carl Franklin, he founded the Two Keto Dudes podcast, over 250,000 monthly downloads, and the International Keto Fest event to help popularize the intervention as a treatment for type 2 diabetes. At age 52, Richard went back to school to study biochemistry. He graduated in 2020 and is now working as a student researcher in a computational chemistry lab working towards a PhD. Richard and I decided to have what my favourite podcaster, Adam Buxton, calls a ramble chat, and just let the conversation go where it felt like going. Probably unsurprisingly, it ran long, so I've split it into two parts. We mostly chatted about COVID-19, and I got to ask his opinion on a few things that have been troubling me. As any of you who have listened to him before will know, he's great at breaking down the science into both interesting and easier to understand chunks, so you will understand why I've been storing up a few things to ask him. I hope you enjoy this catch-up as much as I did. He has promised not to leave it so long next time. Welcome back, Richard Morris to the Keto Women podcast.
G'day, Daisy Bracknell.
It's good to see you. It's been, well, it hasn't been that long since we've spoken to each other, but it's been, I looked it up, it's been a long time since we recorded together.
Yes, it has. You know, Facebook has this thing where it tells you, it shows you a photo that you've published 1 year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago. Mm. Just the other day, a photo came up from 2 years ago of you wearing my hat. And that was when I visited, you know? So that was when I came to visit.
That was so funny, wasn't it?
You thought it was going to be Louise.
I know. That was hilarious.
She stitched you up.
And my outside light wasn't working either. No. So when I opened the door and it was pitch black, wasn't it? Yeah. I don't think there was even, there was no moon. It was absolutely pitch black dark. And so I just looked out into nothing. And this voice came back.
Yeah. And it wasn't what you, the person you were expecting either.
It was not.
A strange male voice with a weird accent. Yeah. The taxi driver didn't want to drop me off. He was like, you don't speak enough French to be able to survive here. And I'm like, well, I don't think I need to speak to survive necessarily. But
I don't know. I could have had you run the gauntlet.
Yeah.
Get all my machines out. Have you go through the chainsaw and the digger and all the rest of it before I let you in.
Well, I had to go through the path of salamanders.
Oh, gosh, yes. You know, weirdly, it's almost like you took them with you. I've hardly seen them since you were here.
Wow.
There were loads of them that winter. They always seem to
that
come
day.
Out. It
yeah,
must
yeah.
be. They must kind of do the opposite to some creatures that hibernate in the winter. I don't see them in the summer. I'd think of seeing them in the summer, yeah. but it's round about that sort of towards the tail end of the year that I usually see them.
Interesting.
They come out and they sort of lurk under the leaves, and when it's been a bit wet, you see them. Maybe it's just because I haven't been out at night. That might be more the reason.
I don't know enough about the biology.
Because that's when you see them. You don't see them during the day.
No, no. It must be some kind of thermoregulation.
Mm.
So that kind of makes sense.
But they're interesting looking things.
How have you been?
I've been okay. It's been an interesting year for me.
Yeah.
I know it's been an interesting and a year of upheaval for most people, but conversely for me, it's been a year of upheaval in a good way. Sort of started badly and it's ending very well with a move back to the UK. So I feel very lucky to say it's been a good year for me. But I think most people say the opposite.
I feel the same way.
Do you?
Yeah,
oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I know. I feel almost survivor guilt, almost guilty.
Exactly.
About that it's actually been quite good for me because, you know, I'm studying. That's not changing. It probably won't change for the next 4 years. And I can do that remotely if I need to. And I'm with a good bunch of people. So it's almost hasn't affected me. And yet, you know, for people who live hand to mouth, have to work for a living and are in the situation where they have to choose between getting infected with a virus or eating, I mean, it's just horrible. It's
exactly.
It's incredible. So, it's been tough times for everybody. And I feel kind of guilty that it's been remarkably easy for me. But I did graduate this year, which was kind of cool. I did study immunology. I actually did some immunology courses, which was also kind of cool.
That was really good then for looking at all the information about COVID.
It's very timely.
It's nice when you have a better level of understanding.
Yeah. Well, they actually brought experts from the CSIRO, which is our, I guess you could say it's our version of the NIH. It's our sort of peak scientific body. Brought experts on virology and immunology in to lecture us about coronaviruses in general. That was just part of the curricula that they were going to go through. But the perfect thing was we had this live data of a pandemic that was going on at the moment. So it was awesome.
Mm. No, it's strange. Like you say, that's exactly how I felt. I felt very guilty when people are sort of asking in general how this year has been affecting you and expecting you to say badly. I mean, I'm just set up for this. You know, I kind of live the life of a hermit anyway.
Yeah, so do I.
The work I do is either online or it's gardening in empty gardens. So, you know, I don't have contact with people other than when I go out shopping or social. I mean, the thing that I've missed is socializing.
Sure.
I don't do a huge amount of that, but I have friends, a couple who usually come separately actually, but are here at least once a month or every couple of weeks.
Right.
Who, you know, we see each other I have this really good exchange system with Pete, one half the couple, who I cook for him and then he'll take me out to dinner. I feel that's a good and fair exchange.
A good deal.
Yeah, I like that deal.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've realized just how it's made it apparent just how important things like that are when you don't have them anymore.
Yeah.
But that's really the only big, big difference in my life that I've just seen, even fewer people than I normally do.
It's kind of been a good year for introverts.
Mm, yes, it's definitely been our year.
We've all got to live that way. For the introvert hermits, it's been...
We have been preparing for this.
I was made for this.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's been a horrible year otherwise. And
exactly.
Carl got coronavirus very early in March.
Yeah, very early on, wasn't it?
And he still can't smell or taste anything. So,
really,
you know, he's still having long-term effects. His blood sugars are all over the place.
That's, to me, what seems to be the most underestimated thing. People either focus on the fact that you might be in an area that has really low incidence rate, like where I am, for example. Mm-hmm. I'm in one of the lowest incidence rates in France.
Nice.
And funnily enough, where I'm moving to in the UK has one of the lowest areas as well.
Nice.
But it's sort of either people talking about that, or you get the whole sort of conspiracy theory side where it just denies it exists.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I think that's gone away now because it's very difficult to deny it exists.
Although apparently, I mean, I've got friends who are work in the healthcare system who actually have people who have it who deny it, would you believe? So,
yes.
You know, denial is still strong in some places. But you get from that, you know, to this other extreme of talking about the death rates and focusing in on the percentage of death rates, which obviously is something that worries people and is something that, you know, you need to talk about. But what seems to get talked about less is that, which must be the majority, is that mass in between of people who don't just have it and have minimal symptoms and it goes away. Maybe even they're asymptomatic, or maybe they have quite horrible symptoms, but it clears up within a month or something. But it's all these people, and there seem to be a lot of people, who are having lingering effects, or it's coming back and hitting
long
them another
COVID.
Time, or they're potentially already know that they're stuck with something. I read an article about higher incidence of strokes in young people who are getting it, for example.
Right.
It's
blood
all these potential
issues.
Long-term and lingering effects that I think we should be a lot more worried about.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, a lot of the people who made claims early on that this was not a big deal had no evidence to do that because it was novel virus. We didn't know what long-term effect it would be. You know, we don't know. And a lot of people who've said, you know, it only affects people over 80. That's the only group for which it's got a large enough mortality rate. The problem is somebody who's over 80 is probably only going to live 5 to 10 years anyway. A mortality for somebody that will give them 5 years less life is tragic, obviously, for the individual and their loved ones. But it sounds like it's not as big a problem as somebody, you know, who is younger. But then somebody who is in their 20s or 30s that gets this and has lingering effects for 40, 50 years – that's also worth considering. So,
yeah, quality of life for the rest of your life when you're young.
Yeah.
And I think that's what just needs to come a lot more to the forefront. So people are thinking, well, you know, I'm not at risk. I'm not going to die. I don't need to worry about it.
Right.
And a lot of people seem to be thinking that way.
Yeah.
Whereas I think a lot of people need to be thinking, well, I need to be a bit worried about getting this because of the potential at least lingering effects, but maybe long-term effects that are going to affect the rest of my life. That's something much more troubling that a lot more people need to be thinking about and worried about, I think.
Yeah, I think there is the individual perspective, you know, how is it going to affect me? How is it going to affect people I care about? So there is that. But there is also the perspective that this virus goes extinct when it can't find another host. So as long as we as a species can make it as difficult as possible for it to jump from one person to another. We've got a lot of tools that we can do that with. Some of them are difficult and some of them are easy. As long as we can do that and get its reproduction rate below one, it goes away. Mm. That's the thing. It goes extinct. It's an existential fight for the virus to essentially what its job is to become endemic in human beings, to be here like the other four coronaviruses that cause the common cold. And because of some of these long-term effects and, of course, the mortality effects, we can't afford that as a species. We have to knock this on the head. You know, the individual approach, sure, how's it going to affect you individually? But we as a species have to make it as difficult as possible for this virus to move from host to host so that it goes extinct before it becomes better at staying in human beings.
That's right.
You know, if it becomes endemic, and this is the problem with, you know, a population like America that's had, what, 13 million infections. Each of those people probably has a billion viruses have reproduced in their body, and that's a billion opportunities for it to find just the one trick that allows it to stay in the human population forever.
Mm.
So, you know, it's a community thing. We really have to take communal action as a species to try and use our big brains to get this thing extinct before it can work out a way to stay with us forever. It's existential for the virus. It's not existential for us, but it's important. And, you know, the things that we learn from this virus, we'll be able to use for the next one that comes along because, you know, these things are mutating all the time.
I think you're absolutely right. And I've had some interesting conversations with people, you know, in my Facebook group and in particular, I have a smaller Patreon group and we talk about these things quite a lot. And I think it is very interesting from a cultural point of view, how people have approached it. And we were saying how interesting it is that the Asian cultures and cultures that offshoots from that. So one of the women in the group is from Hawaii and a large proportion of the population comes from those kind of cultures. And their approach in general, nothing to do with the virus, is very much more of community, thinking of community, thinking of family.
Right.
It's the norm to look after your family. I mean, this was the case for my father in Thailand. The family he is with now is my stepmother. She's one of nine sisters. And when her father died, the mother basically just went from living with one of the daughters to another.
Right.
And she just moved around. And so she'd be living with my stepmother and my father for a few months. And then she'd go and live with someone. They take care of each other and they think about each other. So, and they're much more likely and they will just take on board things like mask wearing, hand washing, keeping distance, thinking, respecting about others.
Yeah.
And that just seems to, you seem to be able to see with different cultures. You look at America and you look at the UK is a bit similar, much more individualistic, much more likely to have pushback when it comes to mask wearing,
yeah,
not being allowed to go to the pub, you know, all these things. There does seem to be a cultural approach that I think we need to look at some of these cultures that have much more of a community and family mindset.
Yeah.
In general, I think it would be interesting how many of these things we can adopt and move forward with and be better for it,
yeah,
as well as a world.
I don't think it's necessarily only Asian nations. The Kiwis, for example, are quite community-oriented as well,
mm-hmm,
more so than the Aussies, and the Aussies are probably more so than the Brits or the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were Australians who pissed and moaned about having to be locked down and wear masks and all these kinds of things. I don't recall much of that in New Zealand. Their lockdown was less harsh. Ours was only one state.
Right.
The rest of Australia was pretty much unaffected. And because we were able to individually isolate one state and regions within that state, we were able to knock it on the head, knock the pandemic on the head. We essentially in Australia, I think we have like 9 cases a day.
I was going to say, so are you pretty well clear? Because, I mean, anywhere that's an island,
yeah,
has a potential very, very distinct,
yeah,
advantage. And anyone who hasn't used, yeah, that.
Like Hawaii is the best state in the US.
Yeah, exactly. And as you, yeah, mentioned, New Zealand, that was the thing, really. If you were an island, you had that potential advantage, you should have gone in hard and early.
Unless you were England.
Exactly.
For some, yeah, reason, England, they're an island, but they didn't get the advantage of it.
Well, because they didn't go in hard enough and early enough, one could argue.
I think that's what it is. Yeah, it's a combination. You have to be able to close off your borders. And if you're an island, that's easier.
Mm.
But, you know, I mean, Canada have closed off their borders with America. So it's possible if you have a large, that's one of the largest land borders in the world,
mm,
totally closed off. So, yeah, so that's it. You've got to be able to restrict new cases coming into your country so that whatever it is that you do, you can do individually with just that country without having this source of virus coming in. And then you've got to be able to lock down individual regions. And I think one of the important things that we're going to learn from this is that you need to be able to adjust as there's more or less cases.
Yeah.
And everyone needs to know what the rules are so that you know. Back after September 11, they had like color scale terrorism color scale. So, you know, it was code yellow or code orange or code red. And each of those meant you knew what you had to do when that changed. Mm-hmm. So that kind of thing, I think we're going to learn that this is probably an approach to get everybody all rowing in the same direction. We need to be able to all know what the rules are and why they're there and the like. And I think probably one of the worst things for this pandemic was that we had a US election in the middle of it. Yeah. Of course, that was, you know, it became political. You could tell whether somebody was, what side of politics they were on, whether they wore a mask, you know. Mm-mm. That was unfortunate.
Yeah, which really doesn't help. One of the problems with the UK actually is inconsistency.
Right.
Inconsistency with advice and rules, and it just makes it so difficult. Mm. Like you were saying, you need to know what you need to do. It needs to be very clear. Mm. So they'll have rules, for example, about how many people can get together wherever it is at various times in a lockdown. It might be outside, it might be in own homes, whatever it is. But there was a point a while ago where the number of people in England was different from Wales, was different from Ireland, was different from Scotland. I mean, that's just effing ridiculous, basically.
Yeah.
So it's that lack of consistency. France was actually quite good when Macron delivered his speech. He did basically what you said. He said, right, so we're taking the kind of restrictions we had the first time round, but we're also taking what we learned from what happened that time around.
Nice.
So things like the impact on people who live alone, yeah, the elderly, the vulnerable, whatever, and actually talked about things like the impact on mental health. So yeah, this is what we learned from what happened last time. So although we're having to have another lockdown, we've figured out some ways of mitigating that and helping those people. And, you know, talking about the economy. So obviously we still have to lock down, but we're going to do as little as we can, the things that we really have to, that could make spread easier, like restaurants and bars. Okay, we're going to have to lock down, but there's money available for those businesses. So they'd really sat down and thought about it. Whereas the UK just seems a little bit haphazard and nobody really knows why they're doing things, why they're not doing things. They're inconsistent.
Yeah.
So you can understand why, you know, the average member of the public is frustrated,
oh, yeah,
a little bit cross, well, very cross, because they don't know whether they can go to the pub or not,
yeah,
who they can socialize it when, what's going to happen at Christmas, and, you know, and then it gets, you've got different rules where you could potentially have two streets apart because one's in Wales and one's in England that have completely different rules anyway.
That's ridiculous.
It just gets, yeah, ludicrous, absolutely. So I, yeah, think, yeah, consistency and showing that you've actually thought about it. I think most people have sympathy for governments in that this is a really tricky situation because nobody really knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
But what we want you to do is to show us that you've thought about it and you're trying to be as considerate and helpful as you can.
Right.
And then we'll play by the rules that you please make consistent.
Yeah. Melbourne went through a really horrible lockdown. If you were caught not wearing a mask, the police would give you a mask, would give you a disposable. And if you didn't wear it, if you refused the disposable mask, it was a four-figure fine.
Wow.
So it was like $1,300 fine. Mm. And people freaked out, you know, about the whole thing.
I bet they put the mask on, though.
They did, yeah. It's financially worth it. You couldn't go more than 5 kilometres from your home. It was essentially a curfew. And it took almost 13 weeks to get from 700 cases a day to zero. And they've had zero now for 30 days.
Wow.
They're going to have a Boxing Day test. They're going to have a five-day test at the MCG with 100,000 people every day.
Huh.
And that is because they were able to lock down individually. They locked down the city from the rest of the state. They locked down regions independently. And they basically got to the point where the new cases were only in the city, and then they had a really massive test and trace program. And I think that was another part of the whole thing. But it's certainly, it's a method to be able to get your nation to the point where there's no virus. And then hopefully, I mean, we didn't know that there would be a vaccine available.
Mm.
This was based on, you know, do everything you can to stop deaths. That was the theory. But now that we know that there are vaccines going to be available, the Australian government is planning to start vaccinating people in March, and they expect to have 25% of the population vaccinated by September.
And of course, with doing that, the technique that you've used, you know where to start using those for the largest efficacy. It makes it feel very unfair for the people in that area who have been strictly locked down when the rest of the country haven't. Yeah. But presumably that really helps with the other things that you have to take into account with that balancing equation, with things like the economy and things like that. Yes. So although it's unfair if you happen to be in that area, it helps keep the rest of the country running by not locking down everywhere.
Right. Well, more money went
to... It has benefits.
More money went to Melbourne in welfare during the time. Mm. Because, you know, the welfare methods were extended to make sure that they could, basically to make sure that paying people to not go to their job and stay at home. And I think that was very effective.
Yeah, because as you said before, not put them in that position. Obviously, there are still, you know, frontline workers.
Essential workers,
yeah. Essential workers that still have to go to work. But for the rest of those people who are not putting them in that position where they're forced to make that choice.
Mm.
Well, it isn't a choice, is it?
No.
If you know, you either eat or you... So you have to put that other system in place that effectively pays them to be able to stay at home.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of it both ways.
Yeah, yes. But it's, yeah, we're going to learn a lot of things about this. A lot of comments that people made in the early days, I don't believe they had the data to make the comments that they did. And there were a lot of people in the low-carb community who may have sort of flirted with anti-vaccination in the past. Certainly, there's a lot of – because the low-carb community is essentially a protest movement against the orthodoxy, it becomes easy to sort of fall into protests against other orthodoxy.
Mm.
And so there's a lot of people in the low-carb community for whom I've lost respect in this, because there were a lot of claims that were made that there was no factual basis on which to make those claims. That was kind of sad. I've gotten to the point now in the low-carb space where I do my thing and I'm doing my research and basically staying in my lane, essentially. So I'm not going out and publicly calling out people for being fools, you know.
Well, no, because what's the point, really? Yeah. I think a lot of people have done the same. It's just a case of it's become easier just to unfollow a whole lot of people so you don't see what they're saying.
Yeah.
Like you say, we're all kind of primed to be a bit like that.
Yeah.
Because we naturally question things. And I don't think actually there's anything wrong with questioning it. I've gone through different phases with my thoughts about COVID.
Yeah.
And about, you know, masks and lockdown and the different decisions that are being made. But I think that's natural.
Yes.
I think, you know, we're primed to think like that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with questioning things. It's just coming out and saying, this is just a big government con and being absolutely rigid about it. But then again, as you know, this is the element of the keto community in particular that I've had a bugbear with for years anyway,
yeah.
Is that very dogmatic. This is the way you keto and there's no other way to do it. And it feels like that.
Yeah.
It's that same kind of singular blinkered vision.
Yeah.
Whereas the people who are just questioning things and digging into stuff, that I have respect for,
sure.
Because it's just a questioning mind. Because as you say, nobody knows.
Yeah, changing your opinion based on new data.
Yeah, and keep changing as you go.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I made a special effort in the lead up to the 2016 election in the US and also in the lead up to this election and in the interregnum between them to not block anybody whose political views I didn't agree with. So I ended up with a lot of people whose political views I didn't agree with. Which was interesting because I got to see a lot of the craziness coming, you know. So there was that. But also it was interesting because the people in both camps were saying loudly on Facebook, I don't know anyone voting for the other guy.
Mm.
I don't know anyone. You know, our guy will definitely win because I don't know a single person voting for the other guy. And I'm like, geez, you know, there's like 50% on both sides. You people must have blocked everybody you don't agree with. So I think it's actually unhealthy to do that. I think you should try and make an effort to go out and make a friend with somebody who entirely disagrees with you politically, just so that you can see their point of view, because you might learn something.
It's difficult. It's a balance, isn't it? I can understand people who unfollow, especially when the environment becomes so toxic,
yes.
Because there's that balance between actually getting to the point where you have to shield yourself from all that for a while.
Yes. There's some been some truly horrible stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I've started watching the news again, for example, right. But I haven't watched the news for years because it just used to stress me out too much. So I just stopped.
Hmm.
And stuff used to, if anything really important happened, like I think I found out about COVID-19 with it trickling down through my Facebook feed.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen it on the news because I wasn't watching the news. So if things are important enough, you will find out about them a different way. And that was, I just did that as a sort of self-protection mechanism.
Mm.
But I've started watching it again a bit more. So I do understand why people have to put themselves in a bit of a protective bubble if it becomes too toxic. Mm. But yeah, I think you're right. As the environment gets a little bit less toxic, we can come out of our nuclear bunkers and start listening to alternative points of view.
Yeah.
I agree with you. It's a good idea.
True enough.
What do you think about, you mentioned that you already had as part of your lectures, they were lecturing you about other coronaviruses.
Mm-hmm.
And you spoke about, you know, what we really need to do is pull together as a community and stamp COVID-19 out.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's possible?
Yes.
I'm not asking you for a definitive answer, but do you think that's possible? Or do you think it's going to become another one of the coronaviruses that we just have to live with and vaccinate, like flu vaccines that kind of work but don't completely work because obviously they're still around every flu season? What do you think is going to be the way this thing goes? What are we going to be saying in 3 years' time about COVID-19?
So, one, I don't know. I have a couple of data points from which to try and extrapolate, but there are some differences between the coronavirus and influenza. They're both RNA viruses. Viruses can be based on DNA. They can be based on RNA. They can be based on single strand, double strand of both kinds. RNA in particular is quite unstable. The reason that we evolved the ability to encode our information in DNA is because it's extremely stable. And it's why you can sort of pull up a 40,000-year-old Neanderthal bone and get some DNA sequences out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because DNA itself is really quite stable. RNA isn't. RNA is cosmic radiation will modify the bases in RNA all the time. So RNA mutates a lot more quickly than DNA. And the coronavirus is massive. It's one of the largest RNA viruses. It's like 30,000 base pairs. I don't know quite what the size of influenza is, but it's quite a lot smaller. I don't think there's any virus as large as the coronaviruses. So what they have done, because they're long, because it's a lot of bases, and because mutation is more common, you would think that the coronavirus would mutate faster than the influenza virus. But the coronavirus has actually had this very clever error-checking mechanism on the engine that converts that RNA into proteins and replicates that RNA to make new viruses. What it does is it's an error checking code, so it basically checks to make sure that there hasn't been a mutation in the strand of RNA, and it lets very few mutations get through. So,
oh, interesting.
Yeah, so it's
so handy for us, yeah.
It's handy for us because it doesn't mutate that quickly. It's not like influenza, which, you know, influenza from one season to the next will mutate so much that our antibodies will no longer recognize the antigens presenting on it. But in the case of coronavirus, so there was a study that looking at antibodies generated in people who 17 years ago who had SARS-1, which is a coronavirus. It's a very similar coronavirus. It's different enough that you would expect no cross-immunity. So you would expect that a vaccine for one wouldn't affect the other, or an antibody for one wouldn't neutralize the other. But in fact, the antibodies generated for SARS-1 are still 17 years later able to slow down SARS-CoV-2, which is the COVID-19 virus. So that's certainly, it's interesting because it means that there's a good chance that if we can create antibodies that they will be durable and neutralizing. So, you know, that's all we need. So in the case of this virus, all we need is for enough people to have enough distance from one host to another to make it really difficult for the virus to jump from host to host. Put masks between us. Wash our hands, don't share implements so that we're not passing fomites. Don't be close enough so that droplets pass from one person to the next, and have as many people in the community vaccinated as we possibly can to make sure that, you know, if the virus does get, for the virus to get from me to another person, it potentially can travel through all of the people standing between us. And if some of those are vaccinated, that's like a circuit breaker that stops the virus in its tracks. And so all of these things are important. We have the ability to do it. We have the ability to knock this thing on the head. And we have a lot of people with a lot of money making sure that vaccines not only go to wealthy countries. So one of the problems is if vaccines only go to the wealthy countries, then there's a reservoir maintained in the human population in the poorer countries that can't afford the vaccine, that they become a reinfection source. And that's one of the reasons why we need America to get their – the rest of the world needs America to get their rates of infection down, because they are the reservoir right now. So, you know, so it's important for Americans, and it's important for the rest of us to make sure that there are no large reservoirs of hosts for this virus to stay alive in.
It actually hasn't been as catastrophically impactful in some of the poorer nations. I mean, I was waiting to see the devastation that I was
expecting.
In Africa,
you were expecting.
Yeah.
Bangladesh, I was expecting.
India, Africa, I was expecting it just to wipe it out.
Yeah.
You know, sort of based on America, really.
It's bad in India. India's pretty bad. Not as bad as America.
It's bad, but yeah. Well, yeah, but that's the thing. I would have expected it to be worse.
Yeah. Yeah, I think part of the problem, one of the problems is that there appears to be an association with adequate vitamin D and reproduction of the virus.
Yes, there does seem to be a strong association with that, yeah.
So people who, for example, African-Americans in people with darker skin in northern climates.
Yes, true.
It becomes an issue because the reason why the pale skin mutation evolved in the northern hemisphere and in sort of the north of Europe was because we weren't able to get enough vitamin D from sunlight. We needed to basically take as much UV as we could to be able to convert cholesterol.
And, of course, it's of such a vital importance, isn't it,
yeah,
to have adequate
absolutely
D. It's not actually a vitamin, is it?
No, no, it's not really. But it's a funny side story. My mother always used to slather on UV cream and wear a hat and long sleeves all the time. She was absolutely terrified of skin cancer because Queensland, Australia, is one of the highest areas of incidence of skin cancer in the world. And yet she had high cholesterol, and she was having to go on drugs for high cholesterol. And it's kind of interesting that, you know, all of those tricks to reduce the amount of exposure of the skin to ultraviolet radiation also decreases the amount of conversion of cholesterol at the surface of the skin into vitamin D. And so one of the ways to lower cholesterol is to get a bit of sun exposure every day. Doesn't lower it by a lot, but, you know.
Yes, it's very interesting. Yeah. I stopped wearing sunscreen a long time ago. Of course, that's the other thing that people forget. These things that we often find a product to stop a warning system.
Yes, yes.
Our bodies have these natural warning system.
Yeah.
And your skin's starting to feel a bit warm and
get out of the sun.
Get out of the sun.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a good reason for
right.
it. If your skin starts burning, you've been in the sun way too long.
Yes.
So our body's very clever about sending us warning signals. Mm-hmm. We just stop heeding them and think we know better and try and mask them. But then that has a knock-on effect on something else.
It does.
So, you know, we ought to get better just at listening to what we're being told in the first place.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's part of the evolution of our species is that we've those of us who have warning systems that aren't as good didn't end up reproducing. So those of us who are descendants of the people with the good warning systems have a warning system that's appropriate for where our ancestors came from. But, you know, I mean, when I was growing up in Queensland, my ancestors didn't come from Queensland, Australia, you know.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know, so the ultraviolet radiation
came from a prison ship
yeah.
in the UK, probably.
I know the actual date that my mitochondrial DNA made it to Australia because my mother's 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 mother, six generations back, came to Australia on the first fleet, on the comfort ship, basically.
Wow.
And, so I've got the entire history of it. So I know the exact date that my mitochondrial DNA first came to Australia.
Interesting. Going back to the vaccine, because I've been, like I said, I've been watching the news, so I've actually found out a bit about it. But it's quite interesting the way they've produced it.
Mm.
It's not how you would normally think of vaccines
yes.
being produced. They've actually been pretty clever, haven't they?
They have. So normally what happens is you get infected with a pathogen like the coronavirus and your immune system sees that and says, that's not from around here. And it builds an antibody that can recognize it. And the antibody sticks to the outside of the pathogen And you make lots of these antibodies, and basically if the part of the virus that the antibody is sticking to is the spike on the outside, then all of those spikes get covered up by these antibodies and it can no longer get into cells. And that's it. That's one dead virus. Killer cells come along and get rid of it and get rid of any cells that are currently reproducing the virus. And it's a very efficient system. That's how we do it naturally. The production of antibodies from an antigen on a pathogen is how we evolve to be able to deal with these little critters.
That's where the whole preventative argument comes in.
Right.
So the healthier you can be, the healthier metabolism you can be, and it is very important. I know a lot of these people in the community have been shouting, you know, very loudly about that, and that's very true.
That
the healthier
true.
You are in the first place, the more likely you'll be able to put in place that defense mechanism, and it's going to work effectively.
Yes.
So we've got that if our body's working as it should be.
That is definitely the case. Now, the downside to that is you have to get sick to make those antibodies.
Mm.
So you're basically rolling the dice.
Yeah.
And, you know, depending on your other comorbidities, you know, you can't become younger. So there are things that you can't change about this. But if you can become non-diabetic, and we know how you can become non-diabetic on a ketogenic diet, if you can do that, you've removed one of the most significant comorbidities of the virus. So there is that.
One of the things that's cited as one of the big comorbidities is obesity.
Mm-hmm.
My natural reaction to that is, well, first to get a bit cross, because I always tend to do when people
victim
just start
shame.
Throwing
yeah.
obesity mm-hmm. around as being a problem mm-hmm. in and of itself. Especially, like you say, because you can just point at someone and say, right, well, you're obese, so that's the reason why, and it's your fault. So I just always just naturally feel defensive about that. But is obesity in and of itself a comorbidity, or is it, and this is what I think, but I don't know if that's true or not, is it the condition that is leading to you being obese that is the comorbidity, or is it a bit of both?
So the only way you know that is to have enough people die in those categories and to be able to separate out those people who are obese without metabolic syndrome or obese without type 2 diabetes.
Because they're citing it as, you know, whatever, 90% of people who are dying under the age of whatever, they're all obese.
Yeah.
So therefore, obesity is the problem.
No,
and I'm
it's
like,
not the cause.
Well, is it?
No. So obesity will affect your immune system. One of the things that causes people to die is your immune system overreacting. And so, you know, when I was talking about the immune system making antibodies, one of the things that it does when it sees a virus that's been covered with these antibodies is it basically sets up chemotaxic signals. These are like basically sets out molecules like the interferons and the like to basically build a pathway for all these killer cells to come in and deal with the culprit. And so one of the things that happens is that that system gets out of control and just overwhelms the system. So part of the mortality of coronavirus is your own immune system just getting out of control.
Mm.
So if you can be as healthy as you possibly can, there's a chance that that will help modulate your immune system. I suspect that people who are obese have, well, we know that people who are obese have overactive immune systems. We know that they're always dealing with an immune response. So it's kind of chicken and egg, really. But, you know, you just need enough people to be affected and then to be able to look at the data and say, well, you know, so many people have this who have metabolic syndrome, irrespective of whether they're obese or not. So many people have this who are obese, irrespective of whether they have metabolic syndrome or not, and then you can say, okay, well, the two things are the same.
Yeah. It just feels sloppy to me.
It is, because it's just lack of data.
It just feels sloppy. It's like it's an easy thing to identify. It just feels sloppy. It's like, well, have you looked at, you know, perhaps they're extremely deficient in vitamin D? Do they have metabolic disorder?
Yeah.
You know, have they got early onset type 2 diabetes? Well, you know, what else is going on there that is actually more likely to be the problem?
Right.
I mean, that's what I think, but I didn't know if I was just speaking from defensiveness.
So one of the interesting things I learned when I was studying this, because COVID-19 was happening, we had no labs. And in immunology, we normally would run PCR tests and we'd do all of the, you know, and do lateral flow assays and things like that. But because we couldn't do any labs, what they did was they gave us a journal club task to do, which is where you get a paper, an actual paper from the literature, and you have to analyze it and you have to present your analysis of it to the rest of the class, and then you get graded on how well you've analyzed it. And so the paper that we were given was on how bats survive such a high viral load. Hmm. Why is it that bats seem to be the reservoir for these viruses? Why do the viruses are able to survive in bats long enough to transition to another mammal, but they don't seem to do damage to the bat? And it turns out that, well, this paper successfully argued that the bats are able to genetically modulate their NLRP3 inflammasome. Well, that was interesting because it turns out that beta-hydroxybutyrate, which we make when we're in ketosis, also modulates the NLRP3 inflammasome. So it's quite possible that being keto can help modulate the inflammatory cascades that go wrong. So it's certainly a hypothesis, and I presented it in my presentation and
of course you did.
And people's heads kind of exploded because they didn't know we were going to be talking about coronavirus. But it's an interesting point. And we really need a lot of people to – we need a large amount of data to be able to sort out these kinds of very small differences. So I'm kind of hoping that we knock this thing on the head before we have enough data to be able to work that kind of thing out. But
that's true, yeah.
The way the world seems to be going, it's, some countries seem to be competing for as many infections as they possibly can, which is kind of sad.
So I sidetracked you there.
Yeah, so I was talking about how the vaccine works and why this is new and interesting.
So, yeah, natural antibodies, yeah. And then going on to normal vaccines, I guess.
Normal vaccines is two different ways that we can make a vaccine. So the first way is that we can modify a virus so it doesn't reproduce. So we can make it a live virus, but attenuated. So it's going to have trouble reproducing. Maybe it can reproduce one or two copies, but eventually it'll die out. But that live virus then is exactly the same as getting the real virus, but it's not going to do any damage to you. So it's kind of like...
So you can sort of flood the system and stamp it out a bit like, you know, with doing the other things that you spoke about before of stamping it out by creating distance. Is that sort of how that works?
It's kind of – so that kind of vaccine, it's definitely part of the tools that we've got for creating distance between the virus's hosts. But the other thing about it is that what it's doing is it's – I think of a vaccine as a little bit like – a wanted poster that you put up in a sheriff's office in, you know, country America. And it's sort of like, you know, wanted for bank robbery. And there's a surly character with a easily identified scar on his eye. And, you know, if that character ever comes into town, we'll be sure to get him. We'll notice him real quick. That's kind of what a vaccine is. We're actually giving your body a heads up. There's a bad guy on the loose, and here's what he looks like.
Get ready.
And so the live attenuated virus basically is, here's this guy's younger brother. Here's kind of what he looks like. His younger brother's not as bad a dude, but, you know, if his older brother comes into town, this is exactly what he looks like. So, you know, get ready for it. So that's kind of what a live attenuated virus is. That was kind of like the first way of doing it. Well, I mean, actually, the first way was probably cowpox and smallpox. But so that's a similar kind of virus, finding a similar kind of virus that's going to generate antigens that are similar to the pathogen that you're trying to deal with. That's like the initial way. And then what we did was we worked out, well, we can just cut bits off a virus. So what the antibodies will recognize are really proteins on the surface of the virus. So we don't need the rest of the virus. We don't need its RNA or DNA. We don't need any of its nucleic material. We don't need the lipid shell that it's in. We don't even need any proteins that are inside the shell. We're just going to use proteins on the outside. So that's the second way of doing it, is to make just the spike protein and inject somebody with a spike protein. And then what will happen is their immune system will make an antibody response to that spike protein. And then if the real virus ever comes along with its the same shape spikes, then those antibodies will neutralize it. But to do that, you've got to give them a large amount of these spike proteins. So what they did with this, the AstraZeneca and Pfizer vaccines, which is interesting, is instead of giving somebody a lot of these spike proteins, what they did instead was they gave these people the instructions to make the spike proteins. It's an mRNA virus. So I should probably mention a little bit about how we make proteins. So when we have DNA inside our nucleus, and we take a segment of that DNA, it's called a gene, and we run it through a little photocopier, and that photocopier spits out something called mRNA, messenger RNA. That little segment of messenger RNA, which has got the instructions for implementing whatever that gene is telling the cell to do, that little bit of mRNA goes off to a different machine, and that machine then generates the proteins. So what we're actually doing with this mRNA virus is we're injecting the intermediate piece of information that then gets put into the second photocopier to generate lots and lots of proteins, lots and lots of spike proteins. So it's a way of having a much smaller dose be able to be just as effective. And the cool thing about this was these two vaccines were ready. So the timeline of this, the virus first hit in October, we first had a description of the genes involved in this, the RNA of this virus. That it's basically a long sequence of letters that describes this virus's nucleic codes. We had that, I think, on January 28th, around that date. It was actually, I think it might have been isolated actually in Australia, but there was, so that information was out there on January 28th. Within a week, we had the mRNA necessary to be able to reproduce that particular code. So we were able to create a recombinant DNA E. coli cell that was able to reproduce this particular sequence of letters in an mRNA segment over and over and over again and just pump these things out. So we literally had the vaccine in February. So everything we've done since February has been to make sure that it works, how much, what kind of dose is necessary, whether it's going to interact with any other things in the human body. It's basically safety. Everything they've been doing since then has been safety. And normally what would happen is a drug company, because these things take, $10-20 billion to generate, they like to spread it out over many years and they do everything sequentially. They don't go to step two until they've finished step one. And they don't go to step three until they've finished step two, et cetera, because it's a great risk to do that. So one of the things that the Trump administration did that was really quite good is that they de-risked the entire process. So they basically said, look, make as much of it as you can and start making it as soon as you know what it's going to look like. And at the same time, test it. And if it turns out you have to toss the whole lot down the sink because it's unsafe, we're going to take all the risk out of it for you. So that meant that all these companies were able to do a whole bunch of things in parallel.
Oh, gotcha.
That they would otherwise do sequentially. So that's why, it's been a remarkable story. It's one of the few things the Trump administration did correctly in this whole process. Mm. But I think it's going to be, they will be remembered for that, among other things. So, yeah.
Well, and that's obviously a very good thing to be remembered for. This is where we take a break for a week. So make sure to come back to listen to the rest of our conversation about COVID, plus a chat about bets and more. See you then. To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowoman. Or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman Podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman Podcast Instagram and Facebook pages and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's end quote is from Nnedi Okorafor. What we perceive as limitations have the potential to become strengths greater than what we had when we were normal or unbroken. When something breaks, something greater often emerges from the cracks. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.